Hello and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikaias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you, sir?
Doing well, doing great. Excited to be here. Happy to be here. Nikaias, you sound a little somber today.
Bucks
Suns went down in a heap. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Also, want to give a quick shout out because you made me sit through 9 pods of Chris Middleton, Chris Paul takes. And of course, after this Sunday happens, where both teams go down, we have a guest.
Yes.
I can't have the same energy. So you are once again the king of the Eurostep, Mr. Morale and the Eurosteppers.
All right.
But I'm ready to go.
Okay, fair enough. We do indeed have a guest. We have 15-year NBA veteran, host of Old Man of the Three podcast, ESPN analyst, JJ Redick on the podcast with us. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, now. Excited to be here. Appreciate you guys having me on. Love what you guys do. Love what you guys do. And I have gotten heavy in the weeds on NBA Twitter. And I was telling my wife the other day, I'm like, she's like, you're always on your Twitter now. And I'm like, it's part of the job. I gotta know what the streets are saying. You know, I gotta know what the streets are saying.
Well, one, I appreciate you. Two, I'm sorry that you have to spend more time on NBA Twitter because it can be an absolute mess.
Oh, the discourse on there some days is just, you know, it's just in general, I think in the take culture, really in anything, it's not just sports, but, you know, we live in the sports world and there are some toxic days out there, my friend. There are some toxic days.
I would say yesterday and today count. To say the least, especially when you get 2 blowout game 7s involving a couple of, let's say, polarizing figures. I don't think Giannis should be polarizing at this point, but as you've seen on NBA Twitter, it's the whole bag versus no bag, Hooper versus basketball player, all that nonsense. And then Chris Paul is just a lightning rod on the app. And apparently in the NBA as well, as evidenced by Patrick Beverley having some things to say today. So it's been interesting to track. I'll say that much.
It has been. And I don't understand the Giannis thing. The Chris thing I get, him being a lightning rod. Because I think there are a certain group of NBA fans and certainly guys that he's competed against that he has rubbed the wrong way. And I obviously was his teammate for 4 years. And I could say at times that he probably rubbed me the wrong way. But I love the shit out of the guy. And, he's one of the best guys I've ever played with, not just as a player. He's probably the best player along with Joel Embiid that I played with. But in terms of just night to night, just the agenda with him was always just, I want to try to win a basketball game. And to get to that and to accomplish that agenda, there are some things that go with that. They're part of the CP experience. And I don't think Giannis is any different. I think the agenda with him is to win. And I've been really impressed, by the way. I've been really impressed. I don't know how much you guys have followed his press conferences, win or lose. There's a maturity and like a level of zen and big picture thinking and gratefulness and appreciation for someone who has accomplished what he's accomplished to be so level-headed. Mm-hmm. I'm very, very impressed with where he's at right now in his career.
He's stayed true to himself. And even that seems to rub some people the wrong way. I go back to last season before the first round series against the Miami Heat. And they were asking him pre-series, like, hey, do you feel better about your chances this year? Do you think things are going to be different? You know, it's just like, I don't know if things are going to be different. I guess we'll just have to go out there and see. And people are like, he's coming off of this bad loss. He doesn't have the killer instinct, yada, 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 bag talk, et cetera. Miami gets washed. They beat Brooklyn. They get past Atlanta. He drops 50 to close out the finals. And, like, now here he is. Like, it's been wildly impressive. I guess while we're on Giannis and the Bucks, let's talk about the Game 7 a little bit. JJ, what were your thoughts heading into that series? Who did you have?
Well, you know, I'm now asked to prognosticate for my day job with ESPN, which I don't really like doing. And because I never, as a player, you know, I would look at things series to series because I understand – how important matchups are. And like Pat Bev, they asked him to give a take on a series today. And he's like, well, I'd like to see a couple games first. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. the media, we don't get the luxury of that. And, you know, year to year, series to series, even game to game, as we saw with Dallas and Mavs, the adjustments teams make. Everybody, I mean, I had Tim Legler on the pod, and we talked about this fact that the Suns were just so much better than the Mavs. And after two games and the body of work that we saw through the regular seasons, like, there's nobody in the NBA that follows the NBA that would have disagreed with that statement. Mm-hmm. But it was amazing to see the adjustments in that series. And so I had the finals rematch. I've been saying that for a few months. I had a finals rematch. So going into that Bucks Celtics series, I obviously had to qualify that a little bit because of Middleton being out. Mm-hmm. And like my big takeaway, and I said this a bunch today, but you know, I'll just repeat it here. You know, my big takeaway were two things. Like, there was just such a dearth, just a loss of wing depth for the Bucks. And when you play against a team like the Celtics, and really across the board, I think the best teams right now have a lot of wing depth. But when you play the Celtics, you need that, not just offensively, but defensively. So the loss of PJ Tucker, decided not to bring him back, that was going to come to bite them at some point. And I'm not saying they wouldn't have won with Middleton, or they wouldn't have won a championship with Middleton, but there was going to be a game, there was going to be a series where that was going to play a heavy, heavy role, not having PJ Tucker. And then, of course, Middleton being out, there was no way that Giannis against that defense could create enough offense in the half court that they were going to beat them. And it's a credit to Giannis that they got to seven games. I mean, he put everything into that. Drew just was unable to produce in that secondary role efficiently. And then no one else really could have the offensive output that they needed. And so to me, the series came down to those two things. I would have loved to have seen, even without PJ, I just would have loved to have seen that series with Chris Middleton healthy, because you guys watched it too. I mean, that series felt more like an NBA finals or a conference finals than any series that I've watched so far, where it's like two teams, that one has the best player in the world probably, and then the other team really just doesn't have a lot of flaws, and it was just heavyweights going back and forth. But yeah, to me, they couldn't create in the half court. I mean, you know, I brought this stat up, and I know it's been on Twitter too. Like, they averaged 0.8 points per possession in the half court, and I mean, what percentage of that was created by Giannis? There was no secondary creator for them, and we don't appreciate, the NBA world does not appreciate what Chris Middleton did in last year's playoff run. I think they played 24 games. He averaged 24 points a game, 7 rebounds, over 5 assists. He was efficient. 3-point percentage wasn't super high, but he was efficient. And he was the closer. Like that. There's such a difference to me watching the Bucks play when it's Giannis at the top of the key or on the wing, staring down 3 defenders, all loaded to him, versus them going to the left side and playing 2-man action and him catching the ball on a little lob pass over the top, or him catching the ball on a pocket pass and then making a play or attacking the basket out of that. There's a big difference. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think Chris Middleton was really missed.
They tried to empty the corner a few times. And in this series, it's Grayson Allen handling it. It's Pat Connaughton handling it and trying to get floaters and lobs instead of Chris Middleton. That's a pretty big series. And so I had Milwaukee in 7 because I just trusted Giannis was going to be that dominant, and they had the shooters to kind of supplement that. But it did require, particularly in the half court, like a level of, I don't want to say perfection, but they needed to be firing on a high level and to kind of compensate for what Chris Middleton, you know, he wasn't there. So to kind of compensate for that void.
Yeah, and I said this a bunch about the Nets as we approached the playoffs. I believe in Kevin Durant. I believe in Kyrie Irving when he's on the court. Like, I'm not going to argue with those guys' resumes and talent and what they've been able to accomplish in this league. But there's a parallel there with Giannis without Middleton, in that the margin for error is very slim. Mm-hmm. And when you're a team that has a defensive concept where you're going to pack the paint and give up a lot of three-pointers, you are playing with fire game to game. And that really came to fruition in Game 7.
Did Steele let you get in here?
Well, that move in Game 7 was very interesting, because
as you said, this was a boxing match, a tennis match, back and forth, both teams kind of imposing their will. When I saw how they were defending Grant Williams, I was like, huh, interesting. Yeah. And then when I saw Grant Williams miss, I was like, huh. And then he started to pass up looks. And I was like, look, he can't do that. He can't pass them up. He's got to let it fly. And I guess the problem for me is you were giving Boston an automatic. Like, they knew, hey, he's helping. We got a kick here. He's either going to knock it down or we can keep playing out of it. And when Boston was able to play with the flow, whether it was matchup hunting, whether it was attacking drops, kind of figuring things out, they found a way. And Milwaukee just, I can't be mad at Milwaukee, I'm gonna be honest with you. They gave it their all. And to your point about Middleton, that was their bucket getter. And they needed that against a team where you're looking at four or five guys. Wait, which is the matchup we want to take advantage of? And Middleton's a guy who can just say, I'll two dribbles, I'm up, we're good. Yeah. So that was, it was a hell of a series.
Well, you brought up the Grant Williams. Not, it wasn't early because he'd already gotten sacked seven jacks up, but he started 2 for 7. And there was a possession where he had a kick corner three and he passed it up. And I thought to myself, oh no, like you got, if you got a, I always said this, and Tobias and I talked about this, like for Tobias and I used to say this, we used to say like, if I had a 2 for 7 game, like that's not a bad game. That's not a bad game. A 3 for 8 game, that's not a bad game. I just wasn't involved in the offense. Like, I want to shoot 2 for 18. Give me 18 shots. I'll live with that. I used to get so mad when they were, you know, like the Clippers Jazz series in 17. After the first game, Doc was like, this is not your series. We want you to stand in the corner. I was like, okay. And then, like, I'm getting killed because I'm taking 5 shots in a game. I'm like, okay, but, like, they're face guarding me from Joe Ingles is face guarding me 94 feet away. And my job in this series is to stand in the corner. And I wasn't pissed at Doc, cause I think, you know, whatever, they gave us a chance to win and Chris was brilliant. Obviously Blake got hurt that series, but I would get so mad when, like, oh, he didn't have, and I'm like, dude, I didn't get jacks up like Grant Williams. And by the way, the 8-3 was a flare screen where he's going away from the basket, has to turn, use left, right footwork, going the opposite way. And he hit it. It was fairly contested to go 3 for 8. And then from there, you know, he just let it fly the rest of the game. But there, that moment, I was like, you don't fucking pass him up, Grant. Do not do this. Do not do this.
And this is kind of a conversational point heading into the series. Because I figured Grant Williams, along with Marcus Smart, Derek White, whenever he's on the court, those are going to be the guys that Milwaukee says, okay, we're packing the paint. We're going to help off this guy. We're going to make sure Jason Tatum doesn't get comfortable. We're going to make sure Jaylen Brown can't get comfortable. If they beat us, tip your cap. And so the bet was, even with Grant Williams' 3-point percentage during the regular season and in the playoffs, like, how comfortable is he going to be taking 6, 7, 8, 9 threes? Will he be able to keep the offense going in that way? Will he fire in rhythm? And he was able to do that in that game 7. Once he caught fire, that was pretty much it.
You hope that, number one, he has the confidence, and you hope, number two, someone or some people are in his ear constantly being like, don't fucking pass up a shot. And he's, you know, the guy has worked his ass off. He was a 6'6 center in college. He couldn't shoot threes when he first came in the NBA, and he's shot over 41% this year in the regular season. He shot 50% in that first round against the Nets. So clearly he's capable. And I think, you know, sometimes you do, especially if that's your role, where your role is a spot up shooter, like that's your offensive role. You need someone in your ear sometimes. It's, you know, it's not that your confidence can waver. You just need somebody to let you know, like, hey man, it's okay to shoot every fucking time you're open. Don't pass them up. You know, I talk about this all the time, and I talked about this a ton as a player. I used to get so mad at guys when they would pass up shots because, and I, when I analyze it now, I think the same way. In an NBA game, and specifically in an NBA playoff game, if your offense generates a good shot and you pass that up, chances are, especially in the playoffs, you're not going to get another good shot in possession. And you not shooting, I don't care if you miss, you not shooting actually hurts the team. Mm-hmm. So fire away, fire away.
What Grant has to do for Milwaukee moving forward, is it just getting Chris Middleton back? Where do you think they should go from here? Like, what are you looking forward to them in the offseason?
Yeah, you know, did you guys read John Hollinger's article today?
I did, yes.
Okay. So he kind of touched on, it's not necessarily the death of size, the death of the five man in the playoffs. Because I do think, you know, we can sort of look in context, Joel Embiid being out two games, playing with two injuries, Jokic not having two guys. But the value of wings is so important in today's NBA, the value of size. And whether it was CP, Trae Young in the first round against the Heat, like, you're seeing the value of two-way wings. And those are hard to come by. So that just shows you how valuable Chris Middleton is. But rounding out the roster with other big wings, I think has got to be. And that's where, you know, they didn't bring PJ back, and they signed Semi Ojeleye, who was a non-factor for them. You know, Grayson Allen, George Hill. Again, I don't have anything against them as players. George Hill has had a great career, and Grayson Allen is on his way to having a really long NBA career. But those guys are not big two-way wings. And so they're hard to come by. But, you know, that's got to be the priority to me, is finding a two-way wing.
Yeah. Steve, where are you at?
They've got to get their lineup versatility back with the small lineup. That was part of what I liked about what Milwaukee did. Even if they didn't bring PJ back, they at least had options. So we can put Giannis at the five. We can mix other guys in. When they made the trade to get Dante out of there, I was a little concerned, because it's like, well, you're kind of limiting your scope here if you want to go with this lineup. And then the playoffs, it's Grayson Allen, come here. We're going to attack you. And even though you can shoot, we're going to defend off you. We're going to play off you. And now that gets transferred to George Hill, and that lineup can't pop the same, which means you either got to over-rely on Brooke or over-rely on Bobby. And they just kind of need the whole blend, especially if Middleton is out. So I think they've got to at least have more things in the cupboard to be able to compensate. They need it to work both ends. When the offense was working, the defense wasn't. When the defense was working, the offense wasn't. And that won't work with that kind of a special talent.
That's fair. And I also, to the point about DiVincenzo, like, he wasn't the same player post-injury. He wasn't the same player for Milwaukee this year when he came back in that limited run. And he wasn't the same player in Sacramento when he went there. And I think whether they were going to pay him or not, chances are if he's playing well post-injury, they let it run and they try to go get another chip. And they deal with whatever sign and trade, whatever it is this summer. But yeah, I don't want to say he was a non-factor, because that's, you know, I'm sure he had some moments, but he just wasn't very good for them. And that probably hurt as well. Like, that, you lose Tucker. You don't get the pre-injury version of DiVincenzo. Yeah, you're really hurting on the wing depth at that point.
It's a fair point that got me packed up by Bucks Twitter, but they just needed someone. Like,
you say, well, I'm going to get what on Bucks Twitter?
I got packed up. They sent me over the top rope because I was talking about Dante. But, like, even if you had gotten some from
favor
Jordan
of Dante?
Or,
in
no,
favor?
Yeah, I thought it was a bad move. And they were like, what are you talking about? He hasn't been good.
Okay.
But even if you got something from Jordan Nwora, or you just need something else, because if you only have so many options, you're in trouble these days. You need lineup versatility. You need scheme versatility.
That you do. Let's move to the Phoenix side of this.
Yes, let's, Nikias. Talk about Chris Paul like you did James Harden.
keeping the energy to say, I will say, like, one, I am just taking a massive L on the Suns this year. This was a team that I saw getting to the finals this year. This was a team I tweeted, what was it, December-ish. I was like, there's no better bet to win a title this year right now than the Phoenix Suns. I had them beating the Mavericks in five games. I did not think it was a great matchup for them. And after game two, it looked like it was trending towards a short series. And then Dallas figured out some things defensively. Luka didn't get hunted anymore, or he didn't get hunted to the same degree. They essentially flattened out Phoenix's offense with switching. The late switches on Chris Paul took him out, basically. That combined with the help around the wings. He couldn't get to his elbow jumper. I think it was Evan Sidery at basketballnews.com who tweeted out the stat. Chris Paul took 9 mid-range jumpers over the last 5 games of the series. Which, that can't happen for Chris Paul. That's his bread and butter. But once the offense got flattened out, they also had the issues on the other end. It just kind of snowballed, it felt like. They were showing all this extra help to Luka. They would give him the switch and didn't show help. And so you're basically daring the three-point shooters to beat you. And to Dallas's credit, they got them up and they made them. And when you gave Luka single coverage, he's putting dudes underneath the basket. And so I was, one, impressed by what Dallas was able to do on both ends, but also incredibly disappointed in Phoenix. And to see Chris Paul, there was a report that he's dealing with a quad injury. So, like, if that's the case, like, that takes a little bit off of it. But either way, like, they basically switched him out of the series after game two. And Devin Booker wasn't able to supplement that either. Once Dallas started mixing in the traps and the hedges, got the ball out of his hands. And if Chris Paul can't get to his spots, Devin Booker's getting the ball forced out of his hands. That kind of ties into, all right, DeAndre Ayton, you have to beat these mismatches down low. Mikal Bridges, you have to beat closeouts if there are any. You have to be able to create something. And they just couldn't do that.
Saw one possession. I did game six in Dallas. And I pointed it out. It was in the first half. DeAndre Ayton caught the ball in a short roll, and he got really good this year, I thought, in that short roll spot, not only as a shooter, you know, he was, I believe, either high 50s or low 60s from that like 14, 15 foot range. I thought he got really good making plays out of that short roll. Mm-hmm. And there was a play in game six. He caught it on the short roll. He swung it to the corner. We got a baseline drive, baseline drift, corner three. They knocked it down. And I'm like, in retrospect, I'm like, I don't remember another play in game six or game seven that looked like that offensively for them. Mm-hmm. And there was a snowball effect, I thought, in game seven. And I've played long enough to feel this, where you get down and there becomes this mentality. Each guy has it. You know, it's I'm going to help bring us back. And they had so many zero pass or one pass possessions. And all of a sudden, you know, a slow start turned into one of the worst halves of basketball I've ever seen in my life. And it's a little bit inexplainable. Disappointment is a good word. And again, I mentioned at the top of the pod, like, I had them in the finals this year. And I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed for Chris, obviously, as a friend. And I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed in the slander, and not because some of it is not warranted, because I think we should hold each player accountable based on their reputation, what they're capable of and all that stuff. But I'm disappointed because I fear that his legacy now will get wrapped up in these five games. And whether it was the quad injury, whether it was just Dallas being, making the adjustments and not allowing him to snake pick and rolls and drop coverage and get to the elbow, forcing him left, like all the stuff that Dallas did really well, pressuring him 94 feet. Reggie Bullock did a fantastic job all series when he was on him, like attacking him on deep. Like Dallas did a bunch of stuff. You know, they attacked him, you know, game six and game seven. He gave up 33 points as the primary defender. He scored 23. Dallas had a 118 offensive rating against him when he was the primary defender. Like, they went after him on both ends. And, you know, he stunk. And that's hard for me to say, but it's the truth. And that's where I'm like, you know, I'm just disappointed. I'm disappointed for him. He's had such a great career, and I know how much that last thing means to him. And, you know, as a player who didn't win one, and I didn't win one at Duke, and 16 years later, I still think about not winning one at Duke. And a year later, I still think about not winning one in the NBA. Like, when you don't win one, that it carries with you the rest of your life. And it sucks, man. It really sucks.
Well, I think you hit on a good point. With the way this Phoenix team had played all season, for it to end in this way, where they didn't even look like themselves, is kind of insane. How much do you value what Dallas did as far as just not blinking? Or was this just Phoenix kind of getting out of character, trying to save the day?
Ooh. Yeah. I mean, again, I think about that start to game five. You know, Devin Booker comes out. He's a killer in the first quarter, like always. There was a bounce to his step. Dallas hangs tough. They go 12 turnovers in the third quarter. And you think to yourself, all right, you know, there's no way Dallas beats these guys two more times. So a little bit of it was Dallas not blinking, and we figured out a formula to beat these guys. A little bit of it was Luka magic. And then I think you nailed it. I think a little bit of it was being out of character. And whether that was Book or CP, Ayton, of course, in game 7, Mikal really struggled all series. Like, they were out of character. But, whether they could have gotten Eric Gordon or someone like that at the trade deadline, there was a missed opportunity there. And I get the continuity part, and I get the fact you were just in the finals and you get the best record in the league and you've had an 18-game winning streak and you had another long winning. Like, I get all that. But, Dallas didn't do anything crazy. Why would you play drop coverage against Chris Paul in the playoffs? It doesn't work. We've seen that time and time again. Why would you? Why would you not blitz when they run the backside, the old Manu Ginobili action for him to come to his right hand? Why would you not blitz that? Like, I used to run that in Philly. And when teams would not blitz it, I'm like, what the fuck are y'all doing? you're making it easy on me. It's like everything they did was I'm not saying it was like not good strategy. I'm saying it was like, let's just make these guys uncomfortable. Let's not allow them to get to their strengths. And so Dallas does get a lot of credit for that. They absolutely should.
I think he hit a really good point. To me, it was Dallas just doing little things to try and take each of those three guys out of their comfort zone. Chris Paul, your pick and roll, it's going to be a drop late switch. We're taking away your elbow area. Devin Booker, you're getting blitzed. DeAndre Ayton, we're going to put size on your switch. And just little by little, it felt like they just kind of got away from what they do as far as punishing. Because like they just said, this isn't new. These are things they've faced.
They've faced them. They've absolutely faced them.
They've seen this before, but the conviction that Dallas played with impressed me. Chris Paul is someone who's kept me up late at night trying to figure out. You're watching video before a playoff series and knowing this comes down to, can we defend Chris Paul in pick and roll? Welp.
The answer is no. Generally speaking, the answer has been no. This is the other thing I brought up today, and I don't know that this is the reason that they lost, and I don't think it is, but they're offense is predicated on the mid-range, whether that's CP, Book, or Ayton. Like, so much of what they get is mid-range. They were bottom five in the league in free throw attempts this year. They were bottom five in the league in three-point attempts this year. They were 15th in the playoffs in both of those categories. They just don't put enough pressure on the rim. And they don't put enough pressure on the rim, and then they don't get it enough threes. And so much of that, mid-range brilliance that they had, it gets mitigated with blitzes. It gets mitigated with size. And in the wrong matchup, as we saw with Dallas, you lose. You just lose. And man, it's the other thing, Luka's so fucking good. Luka's so fucking good. I was thinking about Chris today. And I said this to Pat because, Pat was going at him pretty hard. And I try to come into anything I do without bias, of course. And I have friendships across the league. And of course, guys, I'm not friends with that I respect the shit out of. And I'm trying to be unbiased with them as well. But I really believe the best chance Chris had to win was with James, when James was at the height of his powers in Houston and they had a team that was built to beat the Warriors because they basically practiced switching for the sole purpose of playing the Warriors in the playoffs. That's why they switched on defense, was so that when they played the Warriors, they could potentially beat them. But Chris was the second best player, and I think for Chris to win a championship, he's got to be the second best player. And probably now, he's probably got to be the third best player to win a championship. And that's just a reality. I mean, we've seen this now for 17 years. And that's not to take away anything, because the other thing I was thinking about is look at all the guys that he's played with that have been all-stars. David West, Blake Griffin, Harden in Houston. Chris is still an all-star. Chris is still all-NBA. He's done it, man. He's done it on the individual level. He's impacted winning. It's just that one thing. It's historically speaking, Pat and I talked about this off air today. I'm thinking of the last 20 years and like when you haven't had basically a top five player and then a true Robin to go that, to go with that. Who has won? The answer is Dirk. There's been one time. There's been one time, and that was in 2011 with the Mavs and Dirk, where it wasn't a top five player. And you know, I think some of that is just CP. Like he's brilliant. He's brilliant. I don't know that he's good enough to be the best guy on a championship team. I hate saying that, but maybe that's the truth. Maybe.
It's just a tough thing, especially at this stage of his career. Like it's hard to compensate for the age and the size. And so when you're able to kind of disrupt him with the switching and putting more size on him, and then on the other end, like he fought against Luka. It wasn't a lack of effort on the defense.
No, again, it's like, it wasn't like Luka like blew by him every time. It was like, he just bodied him. He's just bigger. And he pound dribble, and he's at the rim, or he uses his size to shoot over him. I go back to the thing I said earlier about him and Trey. How valuable is Jason Tatum? How valuable is Jimmy Butler? How valuable is Luka? You know, LeBron, of course, in the playoffs. Like these guys that are just big and multifaceted on the offensive end, they're just so valuable.
Let's move the Heat Celtics right in there. Perfect segue. The Eastern Conference Finals is set. The Celtics did win the regular season series 2-1, though there were a lot of missing pieces of those. Both teams look a little bit different than they did the last time they faced off in late March. Steve, I will start with you. What's the matchup? What is the scheme thing? What's top on the board for you that you're looking for in this series?
Defense. I'm looking forward to watching these teams play defense. This is going to be fun. Two teams that can execute different schemes, two teams that can switch, two teams that can throw lineups out there where you're not sure where the mismatch is. I'm sure both of them look at the other top guys and say, hey, we can guard them. And it kind of feels like a mirror series to me. We can defend. We can get stops. We'll go score on the other end, figure out the rest later. Which team is going to impose their style of play or be able to impose their will on the other is what interests me the most. And I want to see, how does Boston come out? You know, you threw it to me first. That was your mistake. How do they defend with Al Horford is my question. Is he going to be switching? Is he going to be in a drop? What does that do to Miami? Which one of these teams is going to look at the switches and bog down? Is there going to be too much one-on-one? Who can create and generate quality looks consistently? I'm going to have fun with this one. But I like defense. So that's just me. They're going to be flying around, man.
I like the comment about it being a little bit of a mirror image of each other. Two teams who rely on their defense, who have a bunch of versatile defenders. To me, a little bit of this series will come down to like who can actually score consistently in the half court. And one of the things that I think Miami will try to do and should do, you know, because target hunting against the Celtics, I don't know if that's the answer. There's not many guys you can target, you know, in a given lineup. Like maybe the 7 minutes that Peyton Pritchard plays, you target him. But other than that, it's like there's not guys to target. So I think they've got to really figure out ways to get movement involved. And they do. That's so much of what they do. So Bam, to me, is like the key player in this series for Miami. Not just on defense, but him is that offensive hub. They run that X action, which is basically throw it to Bam somewhere on the court and get into gaggle action. It's just random movement, random cuts, sometimes for a ball screen, sometimes for a back cut, sometimes for a pin down into a curl cut, back to a dribble handoff. They just get into so many different actions out of that. And, you know, because I've guarded it as a team that switches all that action, when you run it right, it's really hard to guard. And then, of course, like Bam, of course, will face. You'll get into gaggle action. Nothing will be open. Can he score on Horford, like in that one-on-one scenario? Like, so he's the player for me that is the key for Miami.
It's been a little bit of a running gag between Steve and I on the podcast this season when we talk about the Heat this is the Bam aggression series. This is Steve, sorry, but this is going to be the Bam aggression series. JJ hit it. Like,
what's the Bam aggression? What's the?
Thank you. I've been asking.
I'm just curious. It was an interesting thing, but here's, I don't know what it is. I'm very curious. I just want to say one thing about Bam and just in general about the Heat. I find them fascinating because obviously there's a hierarchy, right? There's a hierarchy. They're going to run things for Jimmy Butler. He's their primary playmaker and scorer. When Tyler Herro comes in, they're going to run things for him. But night to night, there's so much variance in who scores for that team. And Jimmy does such a good job toggling between playmaker and being aggressive and taking 20 plus shots. He like figures that out night to night. I don't think he goes into a game and says, all right, I got to shoot 22 times tonight. Mm-hmm. And so night to night, there's this huge variance. But to me, it always comes down to like, if Bam can score efficiently, they're just a much better team. If you can rely on him, and look, he had a great fucking season and a great Eastern Conference Finals in 2020. Of course, Al Horford was not playing then for the Boston Celtics, but he killed them in 2020. And so like, I just believe that Bam has to be elite in this series, elite for the Heat to have a chance to win.
I'm with you. I would say just to the aggression question, I think part of my frustration with him during the regular season is that there would be these pockets in games to where Miami would use him as a handoff hub. He'd look for something, wouldn't be there, and he's still looking instead of kind of looking at the best, like, okay, go now. Or he'll get a mismatch after somebody tries to switch. I go back to the 2020 season, actually. I always have this Toronto matchup in my mind. It was the first time I saw, or the first time it really stood out to me, that team just placed a wing on Bam. OG Anunoby got the matchup. Like, okay, we're going to switch anything you are doing with Duncan Robinson. Let's see what you do. And they shut Miami's water off in that game. I'm just like, okay, this is the area of growth for Bam. I need to see how this progresses. In 2021, there would be the stretches. You go to the 40-point game he had against Brooklyn where he's in attack mode consistently. And then there would still be possessions where he'd get a small guy switched on him and he's looking for a guy to hand the ball off to. It's like, no, this is when you need to take over. Like, Miami needs a consistent pressure point to half court. And just looking at the hierarchy in Miami, like Jimmy Butler, I think we can both agree Jimmy Butler is their best player right now. But just in terms of the athleticism, the physical structure, like in theory, Bam is either too big for wings or he's going to be too quick and has too much ball skill for larger centers. And so projecting forward, you kind of want Bam to turn into the mismatch guy that he can be. Because I think if he does turn into that guy, then it gives Miami a little bit more of a template in the half court. And so that's where I'm looking at this series, like, okay, Al Horford is a great defender. In theory, you should be able to beat him in space. And when you're looking at the perimeter defenses, the perimeter defenders Boston has, they have Jason Tatum. They have Jaylen Brown, who's better on ball than off ball, but they have Jaylen Brown. They have Marcus Smart. They have Grant Williams. Like, in theory, Bam should have a quickness advantage against Al Horford. We've seen what he can do to Daniel Tice. And he should have a size advantage against Grant Williams if he's playing at 5'2". So that's where I'm kind of looking at him to kind of take charge of this one. But I think he will have easier matchups than Jimmy Butler will in this one.
There's a name you said there that's very important, Nikias. And one I'm keeping an eye on, Grant Williams. I think Grant Williams gets the Bam matchup. In theory, you keep him in front on the face-ups, mm-hmm. turn his actions into a switch, and play out of it. But I think to your point, Bam does have to be aggressive. He does have to be the one who's able to punish like a Tatum or a Brown. I think Miami has to come in waves offensively. It has to be a wave. I've said it before, kind of like a baseball bullpen rotation. You got to deal with Jimmy. Now you got to deal with Bam. Now you got Herro or Strus going off. And now we're figuring out how to close this game. I think their guard play is going to be very important in the series. Those guys are going to have to look to take and make those shots. Strus can't be shy. Herro has to get loose. Kyle Lowry, ..
Out for game one, at least.
If he comes back, he's the X factor to me. His pull-ups versus Boston will be key. But if they don't get that ball movement, they don't have the aggression with the guard play, it's going to be tough.
So you put Horford on PJ to start?
Yes.
Yeah.
I put Grant on Bam. Let Al float a little bit. See how it works.
I don't hate that. I don't know.
That takes one of my questions off the board. I was going to ask, are you starting Grant in this series? Or do you go back to Robert Williams since he appears to be healthy per Ime Udoka?
I think you got to start with Grant. You can always go back to Robert. You can always ease him back in and give him the Tice minutes to start. I think you found something. Grant's playing well, playing with confidence. Defensively, you found a rhythm. Kind of plays into what you're trying to do against Miami. So I think you salute him for what he's done. Hope he can have the same impact similarly. I mean, coming off guarding Giannis, you're probably going to feel some confidence on the defensive end of the floor. So I say you roll with that.
What a luxury to have, by the way, to be able to be like, defensively, do we start Grant Williams or do we start Robert Williams? You know, do we match up Al Horford? Do we match up Robert? Like, it's just what's honestly, it's what makes this team so special. And like I said, with a few weeks to go in the regular season, like my concern with the team was like, do they have knockdown shooting? That was my concern with the Celtics. And I'm like, and all then the last 2 weeks of the season, Pritchard shoots the shit out of the ball. Grant Williams, of course, he was good pretty much the whole season. He's been amazing in the playoffs. And that's not a question mark for me anymore. My question mark for Boston really is always going to be, what version of their offense are we getting? Are we getting your turn, my turn, contested twos? I'm going to go into hero mode and God mode. I don't think they're as good when they do that. And, you know, game two of the Milwaukee series was a great example of that. So many good to great moments in that series or in that game. So many times, you know, a guy gets a kick out pass, has a shot, either swings it or redrives, kicks it to another guy. And the Heat, you know, for years, and I put Toronto's defense, you know, especially when they won it, and for years with Kyle Lowry as well, the Heat are so good at multiple efforts, and you're going to have to make them make multiple efforts if you're going to be successful in the half court.
No, I think their paint touches are going to be key. You got to loosen them up. You got to make those plays, as you stated. I'm interested to see which offense do you trust more to hit the right button between these two?
Me?
Yeah. Yeah. You got to ask the shooter. You got to ask the shooter.
It's funny because I can simultaneously trust both defenses while not trusting both offenses against those defenses. You know what I mean? I don't know, man. I don't know. It's hard. It's weird because it's hard to say. I think for a casual fan and really for anybody that like loves hoops and watches hoops, like we're seeing Tatum play at this level. We're seeing Jimmy Butler play at this level. And we're like, oh no, they're going to be fine in the half court. But then like they go against each other. Those offenses go against the opposing defense. And these two defenses are just built. They're built for the playoffs. They're built for the playoffs, the personnel, the scheming, the effort. Yeah. I mean, like over under average, you know, total points per game in this series was 180, like 185 max. Like, what are we looking at here? Cause there's going to be some 92-77 games in this series. There'll probably be more of those, I would guess, than 120-108 games in this series.
I'm with you. I guess on the Boston offense front, I can speak. There we go. I feel like Boston may have a slightly easier time creating some shots just because of how Miami wants to load up on stars. I go back to the Sixers series, like pre-Embiid. But we're switching hard in actions, and then we're just pinching in at the elbows. We're pinching in the paint. You may have a mismatch, but you can't really attack it because of how we're crowding the paint. I think Miami's going to try to do a little bit of that depending on who Boston has on the floor. And that's where I'm kind of intrigued by the Robert Williams thing. Because if you do put him back in the lineup, you want to go big, try to really pinch the paint against Miami. On the other end, they're going to let Al Horford shoot. They're going to tip their hat, you know, hey, good job in the Milwaukee series. Do it again. And they're also going to try to help off of Robert Williams if he can, if he's not in the dunker spot. And I think they're going to restrict space for Jason Tatum, for Jaylen Brown. That could be a little iffy. On the flip side, they do stay spread out. It'll be a little bit similar. I think they'll try to make Grant beat them. But that should open some things up. They're able to get the ball moving. So to your point, Boston's going to have to find that flow in the half court. They're going to have to keep the ball moving. Because Miami's able to bring them down into the mud, that gives them a chance. Miami's going to want to win in transition anyway. Like, that's where their offense is at their best, where they're able to force misses, force turnovers.
Yeah.
It's all about process and flow, but Boston always has those weird moments where they seem to enjoy switching, go one-on-one, and it doesn't matter. So who knows? There's a curveball, though, folks. The zone from Miami.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to bring this up, too. I like this.
Anytime I feel like Boston is going to come close to a rhythm, the zone's coming out. And that, to me, feels like the one Boston's going to have to conquer to win this series. Because that's going to take them out of rhythm.
I love, yeah. By the way, they busted out the 2-2-1 a bunch against the Sixers, which I loved. You know, bringing it back to high school. 2-2-1 zone. I love how Spo uses the zone too. Like, he's so smart with it. You know, I think it was the game four Philly in Philly, and it was a clear 2-for-1 opportunity on a make, not a free throw, a make, you know, 39 seconds, whatever. And Spo just immediately calls for the zone. They switched right into the zone. Philly doesn't get the 2-for-1. I mean, you could bet your fucking every dollar you have that on ATOs, they're going to run fucking zone. Like, they just, he knows when to use it. And I think he's great. To your point, I think he's great in terms of feeling out that flow and be like, oh, here's an opportunity with this lineup, maybe that we have on the court or that they have on the court. Maybe it's when Robert Williams is in the game. I don't know, but like, let's throw the zone here. Let's throw the zone here. And they use it well. I mean, you know, I thought Philly actually should have used it more in that series, but that's a whole nother thing.
Yeah, that was going to be my next
point. That's a whole nother thing. I mean, they actually had a lot of success running zone, and I don't know why they didn't run it more, but whatever. Whatever. What do I know?
That was going to be my next point, because Philly did have success against Miami in the zone. My question was going to be, like, who do you trust more against the zone with these offenses? It's kind of bleeding into the half-court process question, because it's been
sticky. I think in terms of shooting, you probably, like, in just in terms of, like, guys that can get that quick trigger off, like, I'd probably say Miami, but again, they at times struggled in that Sixer series against the zone. But I definitely trust Boston shooters. But I trust Strus. I trust Gabe Vincent. Like, I know those guys, you know, don't have the resume of other guys even on the Heat roster. But they're great shooters. They're confident. They have nuts. They have stones. Like, I trust them. I just, you know, I won't go back to Kyle Lowry for a second. Like, I don't even. Like, I know you brought him up as an X factor. Like, I'm almost looking at this, them playing this series without him, even if he comes back, just because I know the nature of a nagging hamstring injury, because I've had enough in my career. And I had one in my first year with the Pelicans that lasted for about 3 months. And then I finally popped it and had a grade 2 and was out 3 weeks. And then a week later, the world shut down. So I was right for the bubble. But I mean, you know, those things, they're in real time, in season, they're really hard to manage. And so even if he does come back, I don't know that we're getting any version of Toronto Kyle Lowry. I just don't think that's realistic.
I think for Miami, like, this is a dull thing to say, but you don't rush him back because you don't want re-injury. But also, you don't want to feed Boston a matchup either. Not that Kyle Lowry is a bad defender, but he is 6 foot on a good day. He doesn't move as well laterally as he used to. You don't want hampered Kyle Lowry when you have Gabe Vincent, who is a feisty defender at the point of attack. Victor Oladipo, who is now basically forced his way into the rotation based on what he's done defensively and some of the downhill juice to give you on the other end. So I think Miami should play it conservatively with Kyle at this point.
Man, you know what? We didn't even talk about Vic. Vic might be the X factor here. I know I said Bam, but I think Bam is the key. I think Bam is the guy that's just got to have a big series. But Vic's a guy that can win you a couple games in this series. Like, he's a guy that can swing it. Just like Grant Williams probably has won the Celtics two games in the series, Vic could be a guy that could win them a game in the series.
I can see it. He didn't get to play against Boston during the regular season series, so I'm curious to see how Boston defends him. But to your point, like, he closed out the Hawks with 20-plus points in that game five with Jimmy Butler out.
Yeah.
So he's already shown that he can have a moment. While we're on the stars, JJ, how would you defend Jason Tatum in pick and roll in this series?
Good question. Yeah. Look, I like Bam as the guy on the ball. I like size on size. You know, Jason at times can get too deep against drop coverage. So I think there's some credence to the fact that you can probably get away at times with playing drop coverage against him. And the fact that they do have Jimmy Butler and PJ that will guard him. So in terms of that, those pull-up jumpers, I mean, we saw it early in that Milwaukee series, the way Wes Matthews and Jrue Holiday were getting those rear view contests. Mm-hmm. Like that matters. So I think you can get away with it, but I just, like, you get to the third quarter, fourth quarter, whatever, they're switching. Like, Bam's going to guard him in those pick and rolls. And they should. I was impressed as that series went on with Jason's decision-making. I thought he had some great game seven. He was phenomenal. His decision-making in game seven was phenomenal, but there were other times. And obviously he had the big scoring night in game six, but there were other times throughout that series where I just thought he just was very patient, very calm. He just made the right play, the simple play. Didn't force anything, and yeah, he's gonna have to do that against the Heat.
Let's move into Mavericks Warriors. The Mavericks won regular season 3-1, but no Draymond for three of those. A lot of missed pieces there. We've already talked about the brilliance of Luka Doncic a little bit earlier in the podcast. JJ, what's your big question heading into the series? What are you keying on?
So I have two, I think, and they're both defensive questions. My first question is, who starts on Luka? And what do they do when he starts hunting people? The thing with Luka, and I played with him briefly last year, but I got to witness his brilliance in the playoffs. The thing with Luka, when he target hunts and he gets the target on him, and he believes he's able to score on you, he's going to score on you. Like, when he gets his matchup, I'd love to see his percentages. Like, it's certain guys where it's like, you know, in the Clippers series last year, like, if Zubac was on him, he probably shot 90% from series. I'm not exaggerating there. Like, it felt like early in the series, like, Pat Beverly, you put Pat Beverly on him, who's scoring on Pat Beverly? Like, you know, and I think to some degree in the Phoenix series, we saw that with Chris and we saw that with Ayton. Those are the two guys where just like, he just believed every time, like, I'm going to score on you. So how they sort of deal with him, because you can't guard him. Like, he's just too good. So it's, you know, who starts on him? How do they manage the target hunting? And then on the other side, and some of this is probably Luka and Kleber as well, as those bigger players, like when they start switching everything, like, how good, how pristine are they on those switches? You know, I thought Denver was awful. Denver was awful. I thought at times Memphis was awful. I thought at times Memphis didn't switch when they should have. I brought this up after game two when Klay hit the three. It was the worst defensive execution I've ever seen at the end of a game in a playoff series. Like, the fact that Jaren Jackson Jr. was on an inbounds play, was sitting underneath the rim when the play was clearly going to be for Steph or Klay in some form to come back to the ball to get an open three. Mm-hmm. And you're not up to switch at the point of the screen. It was baffling to me. And so that's what I'm looking for, is like, if Dallas is smart with their switches off the ball, if they execute those switches well, they will have a chance in this series. Absolutely. And they could win this series. If they do it really well, they could win this series.
I only had one follow-up question. Is this a sneaky Jalen Brunson, Spencer Dinwiddie series? With what Dallas has shown this playoff run and with what Golden State has shown defensively against dribble penetration, does that open the door?
Yeah, it's a valid point. The thing about irrational confidence guys is when they see a couple go in, they suddenly turn into Superman. And Dinwiddie had that game six where he hit four threes and then he was Superman in game seven. And there's carryover to that as well. He could potentially have a big series. I don't know, what do you guys think? Do you think they start Draymond at the five? Do you think they just rock with that from the get-go? Do you think there's some Kevon Looney in there? Because I'm telling you right now, like, and I much respect to Kevon Looney, but the idea of Kevon Looney in the starting lineup is giving me a lot of Zubac flashbacks to last year, where if he's on the floor, Luka's just going to say, I'm going to score on that guy. And I think you may at some point, whether they start the series this way, you may at some point, it's just like, you got to start Draymond at the five and you go small and bring Poole in the lineup and you just play.
I hate to be quickly cliche, but the Looney thing makes me nervous because of the switching and then his roles on the other end. That's going to give Dallas some help, put two on the ball. And then if you start Draymond from the start, dribble penetration, ..
Yeah, it's valid. Which is to your point about Jalen Brunson, I think is, you know, Dinwiddie, I think is huge. It's huge. A lot of people have been picking the Warriors now for a few weeks to win the West. Even prior, you know, obviously prior to this series and the results of game seven on Sunday. Dallas has a chance, man. Dallas has a real chance in this series. And the odds makers are not saying that, but I'm saying it. Fuck. I'm saying it. They got a chance to win this series.
So Jada, do you want me to let you go now?
Yeah, you can wrap it up.
Okay. Well, then we'll let you go. I guess Steven, I can bounce on this series a little bit.
Thanks, JJ.
Hey, thank guys, you for taking the time out. We appreciate it. You may or may not keep this in the podcast, but I got to get up early to go on television tomorrow, unfortunately. Another long day at the office. You know what I mean? Another long day at the office. A lot of takes tomorrow. Again, I appreciate you guys for having me on, man. Appreciate what you guys do. Yeah, and I think we're going to get two awesome conference finals.
There we go. Appreciate all you do, man.
Yeah, later, guys.
Actually, I would say on the lineup front, I would probably lean Looney. I think with the switches, if you're going to do that with Looney, like I definitely get the Zubac point, but also that I think I would take the Luka step back versus them starting with a small lineup, them finding a matchup, Jordan Poole in particular, just driving it and then getting Golden State in rotation. And that's going to open up more of that'll open up easier threes for Dallas' offense. And I don't think you can afford that if you're Golden State. So I would probably start with Looney, at least match his minutes. This is a point that I think Zach Lowe made on his podcast earlier. I would at least start with Looney, kind of match his minutes with Dwight Powell until you get Maxi Kleber out there, and then kind of downsize from there. I don't think they start small, because they do start small, and this is a point that you've made. They start small, and the small lineup gets dusted with dribble penetration stuff. What's your counter to that?
Well, I think the thing you would hope is if you go big, you're really just dealing with the Luka pick and roll problem to start and hoping that Dallas forgets about Brunson for a little bit. Either way you go, I think the small lineup would probably be one of those game three announcements type deals more than anything else. The Looney thing becomes interesting just because not only is potential of the switch, but you're also kind of opening up Luka leading the dance. You know, is it going to be a drop? Is he going to contain? How's Luka going to be able to penetrate and find gaps that way? Now, does that blend with the penetration? If I was off my rocker, off ball, you might scratch your head and maybe think Kuminga, just because of the athleticism to get there and recover. But it's a big spot, so I'd understand. But the Looney thing is going to be interesting, and also who does Draymond Green guard to start? I think last time they played, they had GP2 on Brunson. I don't think Draymond gets Brunson to start. Does he get Dorian Finney-Smith to help?
That would be my guess. Because I'm with you. I don't think you're not putting him on Brunson. Like with the way that they're running movement sets for Reggie Bullock. So I don't know if you want to do that. I mean, I guess Golden State is going to switch quite a bit anyway.
So maybe yeah.
you ordered it, but then even with that, you still don't want to, like you can't help off of Reggie.
I think he's a natural matchup for Steph, just with how they've kind of put him on those kind of movement players. It sounds dumb, but this is one of those that I definitely want to see what it looks like, you know, because we know what Golden State can do. We know what Dallas can do. Which way are they going to feel each other out? Because Dallas has their template. We've seen it. Mm-hmm. It's been two rounds of it now. And there's not a lot of margin for error, but when they hit it, they succeed. We got Luka leading the dance. He can hurt you in pick and roll if you're going to be in the drop or you're going to switch against your big. We can find the matchups. And if you don't think that Dallas is about to go matchup hunting,
buddy,
I don't know what to tell you. Jason Kidd looked at Donovan Mitchell, said, come here. Said the same thing with Chris Paul. We're going to see it. Stephen Curry is held up defensively, but it's a little different when you have that constant target on you. You know, what coverage is he going to have? How is he going to deal with the matchup? Can Golden State generate the same level of help? Because that was the interesting part about the Phoenix series to me. Initially, the switch with Chris Paul was also, hey, there's people right here behind me. You don't have the space. And as that series wore on, Dallas had some counters, some cutting, flattened things out. That help kind of just like bent backwards more and more as the series progressed. And we saw in the Memphis series for Golden State, when Ja had it, he had space. He was seeing space. So what's the Warriors game plan? As far as showing help, do they give the switch? Is it show and recover? Those kind of things.
Be one of my questions for you. Like, I don't think there is a, I don't think there's a scheme answer for Luka. Like, he's too good, for lack of a fancier way to say it. You drop against him, he can make all the reads, can also get to a step back. If you switch against him, depending on how soft your switches are, he's just going to find a matchup and bully it. If you trap him, like he's big enough and he's big enough to kind of pass over that or just string it out and really force your defense to break. So I guess what poison are you choosing if you're Golden State in that regard?
I mean, you just got to live with the versatility and try and make it as tough as you can on him. I mean, I thought Phoenix had the right mindset to start. We're going to keep Ayton in a drop. Mikal's going to navigate the screens. We're going to try and get back in front. Tough is it's really hard to continue to do that over and over again, especially when they kind of move the target, start attacking matchups. Now you bring your big back. You know, there's just not that kind of consistency there. I wonder, do they just reverse engineer it and just put Draymond on Powell and say, forget it. You have to deal with me on every one of these screens. So now that's off the table. You can go matchup hunt all you want.
But I'm going to be here to help.
Any pick and roll is going to be with me, and I'm going to be a low man to help. I wonder if they get to that.
That is a good suggestion on your point. One I hadn't thought about. That makes sense. And so, yeah, if you're doing that and they start big, then that's Looney on Dorian Finney-Smith then?
That'd be my guess if they went that way.
No, I like it. I can see that. On the Dallas side of things, while we're talking matchups, we know how much you love those. We've seen Reggie Bullock on Steph. We've seen Dorian Finney-Smith at times on Steph. Which one of those guys are you placing on him to start this game?
I mean, I'll probably start with Reggie Bullock. And then if you need to, you can always navigate to DFS over the course of the series, which I thought him guarding Chris Paul, when they made that shift, made a difference with the full court pressure and then screen navigation and switching. But I think you start with Reggie Bullock. That's kind of been his role. And then maybe you hope DFS can bother Clay.
Yeah, that would probably be my guess. Because Luka got the Andrew Wiggins matchup quite a bit during the regular season series. So I would imagine they keep that. So, and on that front, you talked about the matchup hunting with the Mavericks. Like, I wonder how much of it we see with Golden State. Just in terms of like the data. Like they went after Luka as the screener defender quite a bit during the regular season series. And it wasn't as fluid as you would think. I go back to their last matchup. And they kicked off early first quarter. They went with a Steph Wiggins pick and roll to target Luka with an empty corner. And got the easiest bucket you would see out of it. And then they just didn't go back to it. And I'm just like, wait a minute, why? And that wasn't the only time that they went at Luka and pick and roll, try to force him into the action, but it was the only time that they went to that with that particular setup. Empty corner had Wiggins rolling to the empty corner side. I was just like, okay, why not? Just that's a way to get two on the ball against Steph, or you giving Steph a matchup. And if you have Wiggins slipping, you're simplifying things for him offensively. You're getting him with a runway. That's kind of what you want. He's not taking kids to shoot threes. You want him getting downhill without having to think about much. And so I wonder if that's something that Golden State has bookmarked to go to at least late. But I think the key for them, like, they're going to want to tire Luka out. Like, it's what the Suns were able to do, particularly in that game two in the last series. Like, okay, no, we're just going to put him in a bunch of action. We're going to go at him directly. We're going to make sure you are the weak side guy. Let's see what the tagging is going to look like. Let's see what the rotating is going to look like. Can you get out the closeouts? Can you contain? You mentioned this is a Jalen Brunson series. Like, I think between Andrew Wiggins and Jordan Poole, like, one of those two guys are going to have to pop for the Warriors offensively. I think targeting Luka wherever he is.
We're still doing Klay Thompson slander?
No, we're not doing Klay Thompson slander. Do you want me to put Klay Thompson in the X-Factors stance? Like, I can do that. Because as we talk about the template for Dallas, what we saw when they're at their best, it's Kleber at the five or Dorian Finney-Smith at the five. We're going to spread you out. We're going to drive by you. And I've had some questions during the postseason run with Klay Thompson in terms of ball containment. So we can throw him in that camp. I'm just more concerned about Jordan Poole. And so that's why I was like, okay, they're going to need him. One, you got to hold up defensively. Because if you were getting hunted in Memphis, Luka's going to find Jordan Poole. If he had comfort with Cam Johnson, Jordan Poole is smaller. Like, he's going to look for that and see how he holds up. But then offensively, like, the thing that's kind of been at the back of my head with Golden State this year is, like, and we've talked about this multiple times, beyond Steph, who do I trust to create a look with the ball in their hands?
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was thinking, when you go back to Jordan Poole, not just Luka. I believe Spencer Dinwiddie would look at him in a certain way, the same way he looked at Jordan Clarkson. And if Dinwiddie is going, that becomes very interesting. And back to what you said about Luka defensively, I'm fascinated by how that looks, especially coming off a Phoenix series where he got hit and then decided, you know what? I'm definitely just not going to be a liability. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be engaged. I'm going to make the rotation. I'm going to give the effort. I'm going to do my job. And that's what I'm going to do. Golden State provides a little bit of a different threat on paper. And I tie it a little bit back to the Denver series where they could, in theory, make Luka make multiple kinds of efforts, different kinds. Or, hey, yeah, you did a good job switching, but now you got to run off the screen. How many times can you switch? Can you go from help to getting back up to the level? Can they manipulate it that way? That's where I want to see. I also don't think that my man Dave Burt is going to be left alone.
No.
Like he was in the Phoenix series. I mean, if they went at Kyle Anderson, I imagine that Dave Burt's going to be on the list.
Might be Dave Hurt if Golden State is able to find him enough.
That's a good shot.
Hey, man. Somebody's got to do it. But no, I am intrigued. Actually, what are your Klay thoughts in this series? What role do you see him playing defensively? Where are you placing him? How much of a focal point do you see him being offensively?
Well, I mean, they just need Klay to be Klay. They need him to be able to guard multiple of those guys. You know, they need him to be able to get some Brunson action, get some Dinwiddie, get some Luka, hold up, be versatile. And then offensively, be a guy who knocks down shots, be a threat, come off handoffs, hurt you late in the clock, make it in transition. So I think if Klay can just show up and be Klay, they'll be good. The question with Poole is, back to your point, it's not just the defense. How will his offense make Dallas blink? Because a question I have, just based on what Dallas has done in this playoff run, where, cool, Donovan Mitchell, Jordan Clarkson, go ahead and score. We're taking X away. Cool, Devin Booker, have this night, but we're taking X away. Does Jordan Poole fall in that category, or does his offense make them blink? Because if it makes them blink, it gets interesting.
The floodgates can open in a way that, again, post-game two of the last series we saw with Dallas, that Phoenix just couldn't. Because we talked about it a little bit earlier, like they delayed switches with Chris Paul and helped around the elbows. There went his shot creation. If you're hedging and outright blitzing Devin Booker, he's getting the ball out of his hands. There went his shot creation. Now it's all right, Aiden, if you get the ball, what do you do? Mikal Bridges, when you get the ball, what do you do? And for Golden State, you get the ball out of Steph's hands. It's movement shooting for Clay. It's ideally, if Jordan Poole is right, he can boogie you with movement shooting, pull-up shooting. He can get to the rim. And that's the actually falls into a question I wanted to ask you about Steph. Like, how important are the drives going to be for him? Or better, like, what kind of blend do you want to see with him on that regard?
Blend? I mean, take advantage of the drives when it's there. I think he's going to see two on the ball. But if you get a matchup that you like, you're going to have to drive, mix in a couple of finishes along with the threes. To me, that's going to have to be the template a little bit. He's going to have to get paint touches and force Dallas to help that way. Because now if you're putting two on the ball on my pick and roll, and you also have to help on my drives, that's a lot of pressure that I'm putting on you while also potentially making shots. The Golden State thing is interesting to me, because if you've seen kind of what Dallas has been able to do in pick and roll, they've been able to kind of take away the roles of a Gobert or DeAndre Ayton. I don't know how much they're going to want to switch if Draymond's the roller and if Steph Curry's coming off. Two on the ball with Draymond in the short roll with the space and the shooting is a little different. And what that can open up is why I think that Warriors defensive lineup has to be able to hold up. I at least got to find one. Maybe it's not the one we all talk about. Maybe it's, if Otto's right, Draymond and Otto.
Yes, that's the name.
Something like that, to where you can get Draymond as a screener and get the benefits of him rolling against two on the ball. Like I think Golden State just presents a really unique, or can present a really unique offensive challenge for a Dallas team that's been locked in defensively, but has felt comfortable taking certain things away. So I think they're going to be physical. Can they get Golden State in the mud off ball? Can they sustain that defense? Can they rotate against the pick and roll? Can they help on the matchups? Like they're going to have to do it consistently. But, you know, my big thing is, can Golden State evolve from what they did defensively against dribble penetration early in that Memphis series? Because they're not going to face the same type of movement they did later in that Memphis series. But, you know, they're going to have to hit the right notes offensively. They're going to have to mix in off-ball cutting, playing random, pick and roll, the flares, the screens. Because I think part of what made Dallas so strong in these two series is they knew what was coming. And with Golden State, there's an element of, oh, wait, what?
Oh, we defended that action very well. Hey, wait, why is this guy cutting that way? Wait, what is this? Why is this guy sliding to the corner now? Oh, that's a three ball. Oh, no, we've given up points. That's going to be problematic. But I asked about the Steph drives in particular, because I think zooming out, like, this is going to be such an important, going to be an important paint series, I feel like. Because with my concerns with Golden State's, do we still call it the death lineup now? Like, I don't, what are the rules on that at this point? But with Golden State's new small lineup, rather, I mentioned the Jordan Poole question. Like, Dallas was a team that was very good offensively this year without getting to the rim a bunch. And we saw in the Utah series, spread it out, generated paint touches consistently, neither finished at the rim or created easier catch and shoot opportunities. After game two of the Phoenix series, they were able to get downhill. Post-ups for Luka, pick and rolls, extra help. Like, they were able to generate paint touches. They were to generate easier catch and shoot threes. If Golden State isn't able to keep Luka out the paint, if they can't keep Jalen Brunson out the paint, which, would you say Golden State has better perimeter defenders than Phoenix? Like, honest question.
That's a good question. I think it's subjective. I'm going to go with yes. Draymond Clay and Wiggins as a collective over Bridges, Crowder, and Booker.
Okay. That's a, that was a genuine question, not a setup. But I'm trying to like eye it in terms of, okay, is this a matchup where obviously Luka can get downhill, especially if he gets a mismatch. Spencer Dinwiddie, if he's boogieing with the jumper, he's definitely going to get downhill. He wants that to supplement what he's doing. If Jalen Brunson is getting, you know, if Jalen Brunson's getting Steph, who's done a very good job defensively throughout this postseason, like he genuinely deserves more love for the work he's done on defense throughout this postseason run. But like from a size perspective, you talked about this a little bit in the last series, like, huh, it's interesting. Mikal Bridges is on Jalen Brunson now. That makes the drives a little bit different. That makes the closeout attacks a little bit different. If Jalen Brunson is starting to see smaller guys now, does that open up drives for him? Does that allow Dallas to get to the paint more? Does that create even more three-point opportunities? Because not only did they outshoot Phoenix in terms of the percentage from three, they blew them out the water in terms of attempts because they were able to generate them. It just became a math problem at that point. And as great as, and JJ hit it on the head talking about Phoenix's offense, didn't get to the free throw line a ton, didn't shoot a bunch of threes. Like, they were just a very good free throw shooting team, a very good three-point shooting team, and then they were elite in the mid-range. And so it all kind of added up. But if you face a team like Dallas that can bomb away and they have these variant shooters, that can become a problem if they're all hot. And so for Golden State, they have to find a way to keep Dallas out of the paint and to limit the good threes they can get, because that's kind of your pathway if you're Dallas.
It is. I'm going to interrupt you, though.
All right.
NBA on ESPN tweeted 1 hour ago, these stars got now with a picture of Giannis, Tatum, and Luka featuring Photoshop Santa Claus hat. Mekhi's Duncan, Giannis, Tatum, Luka, the league is in really good hands. Should I just try and cash in on my vacation now? Or
what do you mean? A vacation for what?
This episode is the biggest of agendas. Go ahead. Can I even stand in the short corner?
What? This is a bad bit. I'm going to be completely honest with you. We do not talk about that tweet, the alleged tweet in question. Anyway, Mavericks, Warriors, woo! Great series ahead. Rim pressure is important. Maybe lose my train of thought. Thanks. You have officially derailed. Oh, goodness.
Oh, you didn't think it was happening when JJ was here. Oh. Like Chris Paul, I wait to bust out the antics.
That's a good shot. It would have been nice if Chris could have busted out some buckets in game 7. It's a bit unfortunate he was not able to do that. Anyway, how concerned, well, what is your level of confidence in Dallas's bigs not named Maxi?
High.
Hmm.
If only because they do their job. And a lot of what they do helps Luka and does good things for Luka. So for me, like silently, I think I said it on the pod, that trade was for Luka. Mm-hmm. He liked what Powell brought as a roller. Like Maxi, yeah, Dave Burt in the mix. He can now play his game with people who kind of fit what he's trying to do against different coverages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the slips, the rolls, pops. You can get to different things depending on different personnel, put pressure on different guys. I think Powell is important for this team, especially in this series. You know, I don't think he's going to jump off the page. I could easily see this being a conference finals where he gets slandered. I get that. But A, his ability to roll is going to be big. If they're going to be in a drop, you need someone who can get there to make them think twice.
Mm-hmm.
More importantly, his ability to be active on defense is going to be huge. Getting to the level, putting two on the ball. We saw him do it against Devin Booker. They're going to have to do it in this series against Steph Curry. And you need his ability to rotate when he's off ball and guard multiple positions. I think they need him. So I still have the same level of confidence of Powell because he does his job and it works for Dallas. Mm-hmm. And as far as Dave goes, they need his shooting. And depending on what lineup he faces, could be a good time for him. But he's got to work defensively in this one. He's got to hold up his end of the bargain. And if Golden State can manage to play him off the court, that certainly takes some cards off the deck for Dallas. I'm mm-hmm. sure they'll shuffle the deck, but there's a big difference in how the Maxi Dave lineup looked against Utah and how it looked against Phoenix. And if that lineup can hold its own, now it gets interesting. Because now you got multiple, quote-unquote, spacey lineups you can go to.
Yep. That's going to be huge. Like, and that kind of leads into, I want to see what the lineups for Golden State are going to look like, period. So we touched on what they're going to do from a starting perspective. Otto Porter's health is going to loom huge in this one. Because if he's off the table at any point, then that's one less big wing that can shoot on the floor. That takes the rotation piece off the board. And slotting in his place will be Damian Lee, Juan Toscano-Anderson. Maybe we see Andre Iguodala in this series, depending on what his health is. But what you don't want, and it kind of takes me back to, I was watching some of the regular season meetings from the season earlier today. And I want to say it was the first matchup, so the early January matchup, where Dallas ends up winning, I think, 99-82. And it's a 74-73 game, like, early in the fourth quarter. I'm just watching this like, okay, how exactly did this turn into what it turned into? And now I, like, zoom out. It's like, okay, wait. Golden State has Steph on the floor, but it's Lee, Toscana, Anderson, and two other non-shooters. I'm like, oh, right. They can trap Steph, help off, yada, yada, yada. And so I'm glad you brought the point about when Dave Burt is coming into the game. Because if Golden State has a non-shooter or two on the floor during those minutes, all Dave Burt's going to have to do really is give effort because he's going to have help coming elsewhere. And if he can hold serve there, then you get the value from him as a pick and pop guy, as just a general spacer, as a guy that can relocate and bomb away and stretch you out that way. So I am intrigued by his usage, when he's going to be deployed, and what Golden State does to get him off the floor.
Here, you know what I'm intrigued by?
What?
How much and when does Golden State throw the zone out against Dallas as a rhythm breaker, as a rhythm buster? Do they do that to the second unit lineup? Do they do that if Luka's hunting Curry or if Luka has it going? How do they handle that? And who's more important for Golden State to take away? Brunson or Dinwiddie?
I think it's... That's a good question, first and foremost. I want to say... I think I'll say Dinwiddie. Just because I think from a size perspective, Golden State's going to be able to toss some guys on Brunson to where, like, if he's beating you, at least he's going to be able to contest. If Dinwiddie gets going, like, there are only so many guys you can throw at him while also trying to count for Luka and or Brunson at the same time. And I think the rim pressure from Dinwiddie hits a little bit differently than it does from Brunson when he has it going.
And if Dinwiddie hits a wave, you look at the lineup he's playing with. That's a bonus for Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And you know you can always get Luka going. And, you know, Brunson's going to stay aggressive. So I'm interested there. I go back to, there's two things that stick in my mind. And again, we haven't seen it yet, so there's no telling. Can the Warriors hit the right points at the right time offensively? But they provide a unique challenge, but do they trip into, we're just going to mismatch hunt or matchup hunt? And does that play into Dallas's hands? Can they hit the right chords at the right times, keep the pressure on, or will they get slower and play a game that Dallas can play? And the other thing is, can they find a coverage for Curry and or Poole And what kind of help can they provide when Luka gets that switch on Curry? Because he's big. He's just going to body. They're not showing help early. It's going to be late help. And, you know, Luka's not going all the way all the time. So that's where I'm concerned. Just especially, I can't. Looking at a little bit of the regular season game, a lot of space he saw, room to operate. Looking at the Phoenix series, when he had space, it was problems. And looking at what Memphis did against Golden State, Ja had an ocean. Mm-hmm. And if that can be what sustains Dallas in the fourth, I'm intrigued.
I'm right there with you. I'm glad you brought up the tempo point, because that's going to be a huge one. I don't think they want to play in the mud. I don't think they want to get too deep into the mismatch hunting bag. At least not a bleed 10 seconds off the clock, get a switch, and then we're going to go one-on-one. If they're going to do that, they're going to have to play with a little bit of tempo. And just a general Golden State point, they cannot turn the ball over the way that they have through the first two rounds of this series. Like, one, you don't want to feed Dallas extra possessions. You don't want to feed them easy possessions. And, like, they're okay with, oh, turned it over, you got back, cool. Luka's going to mismatch hunt. They're fine with bleeding the clock and going with Luka. Like, that's what you want to do. They want to jump this up for Golden State. They're going to have to find a way to play with more tempo without turning the ball over the way they have. Very duh, basic point. But Golden State has been giving away possessions all postseason long, and they're in the conference finals. It's a testament to how good they still are. But against a guy as meticulous as Luka is, and with the offensive style that they want to play, they are fine with five out, grind it down, we're going to beat you down, get to the paint. You don't want to feed them extra opportunities to do that, because that's more shots for their shooters. If they start cold, that's more shots for them getting rhythm to break that cold streak. And once they're making you pull the ball out of the basket, they're able to set their defense, which has been locked in. They were, I think, the seventh best defense in the NBA in terms of defensive rating this regular season. The defense has held up against Utah. It more than held up against Phoenix. And again, Phoenix was my title pick. I did not think there were many actions to the many sets and counters to the sets and counters to the counters to the sets that Phoenix had. And Dallas, like, nope, switch, help. We're going to alter the help. We're going to alter where the help comes from. We're going to blitz sometimes. We're locked in with the rotations. You don't get any of that. And if they can do that to Phoenix, then Golden State has to be tight. They have to be.
Who do you got in the series, Nikias?
All right. I am going to go. I think I go Dallas in seven.
Wait, what?
I think I take Dallas. I think I trust their late creation a little bit more. And I'm a little bit worried about. I'm just a little bit worried about Golden State, which is a weird thing to say about a team that just made the conference finals. But like, between the turnovers and the guys beyond Steph, I just have some questions. They may be answered loudly, in which case I'll take the L, like much like I did with the Bucks and the Suns. But
you just picked Jason Kidd to go to the finals.
Yeah, I'm just as shocked as you are. This was not what I thought was happening with the Dallas Mavericks.
Can we go back to episode 62, get this man's reaction?
I think I said I mean, my quote. I have several
that, not
questions.
That, not that reaction, but.
That's a wow. But no, like I said on the season preview pod with Dallas, I think I said it like four straight times. I have several questions about Jason Kidd. And he has answered them very loudly throughout this season and throughout this postseason run.
Salute Jason Kidd. Salute to Jared Dudley. Salute to Sweeney. He's hitting the right buttons at the right time. And I will say the mud certainly looks thicker than it did. Now, the thing for Golden State is you have to realize what Dallas's template is and take one thing off the board. Mm-hmm. Just one. If Luka's going to hurt you, you know who can't. Can't be Brunson, can't be Dinwiddie. Can't give up threes. Or you got to score on the other end. If you can do that, you can beat him. But if you get stuck and tripped up, you're going to be in a dogfight. That's for sure.
And that's just not what you want to do. Not what you want to do. Who's your pick?
I don't make picks. I make art.
Oh, brother. Boo. Give us the pick. Come on. Y'all going to have me swimming upstream with Babs at 7? Who you got? You got Warriors. Oh, no, yeah, 6?
You go swim upstream. I'm looking out for this conference finals preview. I can't wait to quote tweet with "Wait a minute."
I bet so.
Sending the royalty check at me.
You got it.
But no, I have Golden State in 7.
All right. And in the East, who do you have?
East is tough. Heat in 6.
All right. A little upset. I was also going to go with the Heat in this one. I go Heat in 7. I don't know if they win the road game 6, but I'll go Heat in 7.
That's a whole zone game. If they're a 3-2, it's 48 minutes of zone, dog.
Just junk it up and say, I dare you. I respect it.
Oh, man. Now, that's the fun part, man. It's a bummer why those Game 7s ended the way they did. Those were some really fun series. And the narrative folk got to win. Just got to have a whole ball. No reward for watching these games. No one wants to hear about the mini battle between Luka on the switches. No, no. Chris Paul slander. Has anyone said how Dallas won the series? Or, I mean, I missed out.
Just us.
Okay.
That's the disappointing part of it. Like, one is just disappointing. Like, you can't lose a game 7 like that. Again, Chris has to be better. Devin has to be better. Like, literally everyone has to be better for Phoenix. But, like, also give Dallas credit for what they did. Like, I wish people would. I understand, like, jokes are fun. Obviously, you want to get your jokes off, you want to get your takes off. Cool. But, like, take a step back a minute. Like, as good as Phoenix was this entire season, do you know how good you have to be defensively to not only beat them, but to beat them at home? And not only to beat them at home, but to beat them at home like that.
To beat them in those 2 games like that.
Yeah. Like,
but it's a lot easier to look at the back score and get to the slander than appreciate what Dallas did. But hey, that's neither here nor there. That's why we fight the good fight.
That we do. That we do. Just disappointing. Also, I'm glad JJ brought up the Eric Gordon thing. So much vindication. I needed that. We talked about Eric Gordon.
Oh my God. This whole pod just for vindication. This whole podcast was for you to avoid the Chris Paul energy that I was going to bring to the table and get vindication on Bam and Eric Gordon.
You can bring the Chris Paul smoke. Like, it's...
Man. Nah.
Like, I don't know. He was bad. They took him out. I wrote a whole article about how the Paul Ayton pick and roll was scheme proof, and then Dallas was like, actually...
Yeah, man, I replied to that, and the Nakia Maniacs tried to pack me up.
One, I don't know what that means. 2,
it's like
I didn't see that.
Hulkamaniacs, Nakia Maniacs.
No, I get the reference, but
hey, you Hulk Hogan. What can I say?
Oh God, no. For at least 17 reasons, that is a let's just call that a hard no for me. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you have not already. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. I will remind you all, if you have capabilities on your Twitter app, please join the Dunker Spot community. We are doing fun stuff in there. We are watching games, all kinds of banter, good discussion. Hop in there if you haven't already. Let's enjoy some basketball, folks. Let's enjoy some basketball.
How many text messages has DeAndre Ayton ignored today?